From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Tough talk out of Washington Wednesday, aimed directly at Russia and Syria.
The United States is not going to sit there and be used as an instrument that permits a so-called ceasefire to be in place while one principal party is trying to take advantage of it to the detriment of the entire process.
That was U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Oslo for a conference on deforestation emissions Wednesday.
We're not going to allow that to continue. Russia and others have to make a decision whether or not they care about the course of events in Syria and whether or not they're serious about implementing UN Security Council resolution.
His warning was restated at Wednesday's Delhi State Department press conference by spokesperson John Kirby.
There are very real consequences for Russia, obviously for Syria, for the region, but for Russia. More war in Syria, the attraction of more terrorist elements in Syria, the potential attraction of terrorist elements in Russia as the war continues to go on, as well as a much worsening, potentially much worsening, migration crisis, with people just continuing to flow out of Syria looking for some kind of safety. Certainly there's going to be more pressure put on already pressurized refugee situations in Turkey and in Jordan, which all puts more pressure on the whole region. So there are very real consequences for Russia and the region if they don't start to use their influence in a productive way.
In apparent response, Russia announced a 48-hour ceasefire in Syria's war-torn Aleppo a few hours after the warnings from Washington. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
The Russian Defense Ministry says the regime of silence came into effect at 2100 GMT Wednesday. It noted that the truce aims to stabilize the situation and lower the level of violence in Aleppo. This as U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry warned Russia and Syria about continued violence in Aleppo. Last month, a similar ceasefire, excluding Daesh and al-Nusra terrorist groups, was reached in Aleppo after negotiations between Russia and the U.S. However, the Syrian government repeatedly accused terrorist groups of violating the truce.
Aleppo has suffered major damage in the devastating war in Syria that has killed more than 280,000 Syrians. Meanwhile, there's been an apparent attempt to thaw economic relations between Russia and the EU with the surprise announcement of a summit by EU Commission head Jean-Claude Juncker, Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, and Russia's President Vladimir Putin at an economic summit in St. Petersburg, which kicked off Thursday. This was Juncker speaking at the opening of the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum Thursday.
We have those who like the idea that I'm here, and we have those who don't like the idea, but I like the idea to be here. Millions of people communicate and trade each day. Russian citizens receive more Schengen visas than anyone else. Even in 2015, over 3 million. And even in 2015, we exchanged goods and services worth 20 billion euros.
The head of the EU Commission stopped short of promising an end to EU sanctions against Russia. But sentiment favoring an end to the sanctions against Russia was strong and stated in unambiguous terms by many of his colleagues at the EU, including former President of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, who told the economic summit that sanctions against Russia should be abolished.
I am certain that it is necessary to lift the sanctions. There are enough problems like that, too many problems like that, between us. But time is against us.
As a consequence of these sanctions, trade between Moscow and Brussels dropped sharply from $417.7 billion in 2013 to $235.7 billion in 2015. Beijing had tough words for Washington Thursday, including a demand that the U.S. refrain from interference in China's domestic affairs. This was Liu Kang, a spokesperson for China's foreign ministry, commenting Thursday on a closed-door meeting held between U.S. President Barack Obama and the Dalai Lama at the White House Wednesday.
Tibet affairs are China's internal affairs, and no foreign country has the right to interfere. The 14th Dalai Lama is not a purely religious figure, but a political exile who has long engaged in anti-China separatist activities under the guise of religion. The meeting goes against the United States' acknowledgement that Tibet is an inseparable part of Chinese territory and its rejection of Tibet's independence and anti-China separatist activities. Such a meeting harms China's U.S. mutual trust and cooperation. We must say that anyone who tried to use the Tibet issue to destabilize China would definitely fail.
The vote counting continues in California. As of 9 a.m. Pacific time Thursday, there were still more than 1.4 million uncounted ballots, those being ballots by mail and provisional ballots. Clinton still leads Sanders, but now by about 471,000 votes, leaving Sanders within striking distance of a win if he scores well with the remaining count.
I have Governor Rockefeller for you, sir.
Hello.
There you are.
Mr. President, I know you've had a hard day, but I want you to know that I just back you to the hilt.
It's been nearly 5 years now since that recording of a telephone call made in September of 1971 in the aftermath of the Attica massacre was aired by Democracy Now! The tape shows then-President Richard Nixon calling then-New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller to congratulate him for sending in a state SWAT team to quash a prison protest, leaving 39 people, 29 prisoners, and 10 prison staff members dead.
The courage you showed and the judgment in not granting amnesty, it was right, and I don't care what the hell the papers or anybody else says. I don't care what they say. I think that you had to do it that way, because if you would have granted amnesty in this case, it would have meant that you would have had prisons in an uproar all over this country.
That's right.
And you did the right thing. It's a tragedy that these poor fellows are shot, but I just want you to know that's my view, and I pulled the troops around here there to back that right to the hilt.
Well, aren't you great, Mr. President? I only called you because I wanted to alert you that we were going in, and
right. When
we went in, we couldn't tell whether all 39 hostages would be killed and maybe 200 or 300 prisoners.
The tape was obtained and provided to Democracy Now! By an historian at the University of New Hampshire at Manchester, Teresa Lynch. In this week's edition of her Freedom Rider column at BlackAgendaReport.com, columnist Margaret Kimberly talks about a call to action made by some of the 2 million Americans who find themselves behind the walls of the country's prisons for this year's 45th anniversary of the Attica Uprising. We spoke with her about
that. This week's Freedom Rider column
Thursday.
About a global prison strike in September?
Yes, this September 9th will be the 45th anniversary of the Attica Uprising, which took place at the Attica State Penitentiary in upstate New York. And in that four-day-long rebellion about inhumane prison conditions, more than 40 people died. 30 inmates and 10 other prison employees were killed. And so Attica is still a rallying cry on the issue of prisoner rights. And in the past 45 years, the number of people incarcerated in this country has grown, has tripled in that period of time. Mm. Now we have the United States is the world's biggest jailer, with 2 million people behind bars. Half of those people are black. It was the reaction to the liberation movement of the 60s and 70s to keep black people under physical control. If Jim Crow was no longer legal, if discrimination was no longer legal, it was the latest iteration of the effort to keep black people controlled.
Yeah, actually, if slavery was no longer legal also, because it actually is, this is the exclusion to the 13th Amendment.
Correct. So the 13th Amendment abolished slavery, but has an exemption for people convicted of crimes. So not only do we have a prison system that has grown, but it has become a profit center. We actually have prisons that are run by private corporations. We have people behind bars. Not only are they twice punished, they are incarcerated and deprived of their freedom, and they are forced to work for little or no pay. major corporations like McDonald's or Walmart or Costco or Whole Foods had a farm with prison labor until bad publicity forced them to close it down, or they work for the prison system itself. And the old image we have of people busting rocks or making license plates, you know, it's ancient history now. If you call a call center for any number of services, if the other person on the phone isn't in India, they're probably incarcerated somewhere in the United States. And this effort on September 9th, there have been in recent years an increasing number of prison work stoppages. These are ignored by the corporate media, unfortunately. In 2010, there was a large strike in the state of Georgia, and it has spread to other places, to Texas and to Alabama. So there is a call for incarcerated people across the country to stop working on September 9th. And there are prison groups such as the Free Alabama Movement, which are asking for support on the outside, because as they rightly point out, they are still under physical control. And this is quite a brave act. They are subject to harassment, to physical brutality, and the least we can do in the rest of the world is say that we're in support of them.
So you invoked the civil rights movement, the liberation movement, as the thrust that came with the parry of mass incarceration, and that also had the result of militarization of the police, which began in the mid-1960s, and of course, with that, the way increase in the murder of people, particularly black people, on the street. So, how does all of this get addressed by an action like this? I mean, how can you speak to the whole of it?
Well, it's part of a larger issue. As I was saying before, it's not coincidental that the police militarization SWAT started in the late 60s in Los Angeles in response to a raid on a Black Panther Party headquarters, which resulted in shootings of the police. And that was the beginning of SWAT more than almost 50 years ago now.
Right.
The beginnings of the mass incarceration movement started at that time. It was a reaction to the liberation movement, the police killings. Unfortunately, there has not been good long-term data on this, but we know that every year more than 1,000 people are killed by the police. So it's all part of a whole: police brutality, mass incarceration. Police brutality is the feeder. We can speak even going back further, the school-to-prison pipeline. You have millions of kids, mostly kids of color, deprived of their right to get a good education, and they're fed straight into the prison system, beginning at a young age. So we have school-to-prison, police brutality, a incarceration system that is in itself a profit center. It is all part of a whole. And the United States, despite its claims of being civilized and advanced and, words of that type, is at the bottom in the world in the treatment of its citizens. What does America lead in? Defense spending and mass incarceration, right, and making movies. That's about it.
Right, right. Yeah, we have the prison industrial complex at home and the military industrial complex abroad.
Right, and it's all about control and supremacy. America, with its legacy of conquest and enslavement, it's largely based on race, and that sort of that hegemony that millions of people, of individuals in this country, live under, is acted out abroad as well.
The you mentioned that list. In addition to those modalities, you have the stop and frisk, And so you have, you know, people can just be intimidated at will and are being by the hundreds of thousands in New York City alone. And you have mass surveillance. And I was speaking with Bob Fitrakis about the election in California, and he pointed out that in terms of trying to block people from voting, as was done there with no party preference voters, there's this massive amount of data off of Facebook and Twitter and places like that about individuals that could also be used looking at Facebook postings of, say, black kids in their, you know, late teens, early 20s, and used to target them. And I'm wondering if there's something that sophisticated, you know, with that kind of a tissue going on, because it's possible for sure.
Well, it's happening now here in New York City. The latest thing, stop and frisk, has been reduced by court orders. It was horrible. Under Bloomberg, there were 750,000 people who were stopped on the street for no reason. Most of them black, a smaller number Latino, hardly any white people. That was part of an effort to continue control, and also as part of the gentrification effort to literally get black people out of New York City. And so stop and frisk is diminished, but not ended, not stopped. The latest tool is the raids on public housing developments. And gang activity is used as a pretext to just sweep up hundreds of young people. And they have been surveilled with social media. And there are kids now in jail who have not been convicted of any crime. They merely expressed a connection or a friendship or support of a person who's a target of an investigation. And they're said to be part of a gang, and suddenly now they're under everything from RICO statutes to Homeland Security, ICE, the immigration agency. They swoop in and arrest hundreds of young people at a time. So that's the latest tool being used here in New York City. But there's always something. There's, you know, you make stop and frisk harder to do, so they come up with something else. So there's always an effort to stay ahead of law enforcement, doing their job of essentially trying to protect white people from black people and criminalizing everything that black people do.
You know, so a struggle, because that's what was behind it, produces a reduction in any event, and an unpopularity about stop and frisk that, you know, builds a coalition that forces a reduction.
Mm-hmm.
But you simultaneously have this increase in technology that lets them target the people that they think are going to be most likely to, you know, organize or to, you know, to threaten the existing order of oppression. And,
sure. Well, it happens all the time. Now there's something called predictive policing, where there's some sort of, and there's always money to be made. Someone comes up with a means of supposedly predicting how likely someone is to commit a crime, and judges use this in sentencing. Now, whatever this algorithm happens to be, it always turns out that black people are judged to be the most dangerous and get the worst sentences, and white people are judged to be less dangerous.
I'm laughing at the absurdity of it, not at the condition, because it's this is
so
horrible.
I mean, I think it's important for those of us fighting this fight to realize there's always a reaction. The struggle is never over. You get rid of Jim Crow, so they expand prisons. You get rid of stop and frisk, so they come up with gang raids. It's never ending, and I think it's important, while that can be, if we allow it to be, it could be something that depressing, but I think it's something to realize that we will always have to do. There will always be a struggle of some kind. As conditions change in the country, as technologies go online, there will be some other tool used against us, and we will have to respond to whatever reaction the system comes up with.
And the city of Newburgh, about 65, 70 miles up the Hudson River from New York City, population of about 30,000, about a third white, quote-unquote, a third black, quote-unquote, a third brown, quote-unquote. Mm-hmm. On two different occasions that I'm familiar with personally since 2007, on election day or primary day, one of each, they had massive gang raids, quote-unquote, in Newburgh with FBI, county, state, and city police involved, and the U.S. attorney coming up and holding a press conference. Now, in each case, there were insurgent candidates who were not of the party structure of the Democratic or Republican parties, but actual community organizers. In each case, one of them enrolled 1,000 or 1,500 voters in for elections that typically draw like 4,000 tops. And it seemed like that was directed at exactly that process. And I'm wondering if that goes on a lot around the country.
Well, I'm sure it does. That cannot be a coincidence. I think sometimes we just have to use our common sense and say it's not a coincidence if that happens around election time. And it happens when there are insurgent candidates. That can never be coincidental. In this country, we have the veneer of democracy and freedom. So no one can pass a law that says if you go against the Democratic Party, you're subject to arrest. They just make up stuff and try to find a way to criminalize something to get people silenced or literally locked away and just removed from the scene. So, no, that's not surprising. And every tool, we have to be very skeptical. Every time there's an effort to create a new category of crime, we must be opposed to it. So these statutes of for gang activity, it's very vague. If more than a handful of people decide to do anything together, they can be called a gang.
Right.
And they are therefore subject to a variety of very harsh punishments. So it can be anything. And it just a very loose connection, a social media post, a friendship, loaning money, anything. This creation of drug conspiracies is one of the ways that drug enforcement has been used to put so many people in jail. If two people are connected in any way, if you let somebody use your car, loan someone money, let them stay in your home, and they're convicted of some drug offense, the other person, who is perhaps completely uninvolved, can also be prosecuted as part of a drug conspiracy.
And kicked out of public housing.
Their families can be kicked out of public housing. So asset forfeiture, where there is no need to prove a crime. People have had money stolen, property stolen, cars stolen. If the police have any sort of vague, reasonable suspicion, the state can swoop in and take your stuff. And it's legal. It's perfectly legal. And these are things that have not stopped. If the Republicans are in the White House, if the Democrats are in the White House, it is something that continues to happen.
And actually intensifies, and again, regardless of who. If you look at the mass incarceration project, for example, goes up steadily through every president with some spikes under someone like Bill Clinton, for example, you know, with a sharp uptick.
Yeah, well, the draconian sentences, these disparities for crack cocaine, which was one of the biggest scams ever perpetrated against the American public, where crack cocaine, it's all cocaine. Anyone convicted of an offense involving crack instead of powder cocaine, the sentences was 100-to-1 sentence.
Right.
And there were jurisdictions where there was not one white person convicted of dealing or using crack cocaine. And so now we're at this point in America where at the early 70s, when Attica happened, in order to get back to those levels of the numbers of people incarcerated at that time, 80% of the people in the country who are now in prison would have to be released in order to get back to those levels.
Damn. That's a lot. That's 1.6 million people.
Yes.
And that doesn't count people that are in county jails awaiting trial, people in Rikers and places like that.
I think it includes everyone. In this country, people can be in a local jail where generally people await trial, or in state prisons, or it's most people are in state and local facilities. The federal prison system is smaller. But that counts everybody incarcerated anywhere.
Serving time. I'm talking about people who are awaiting trial and in for other reasons, like bench warrant to produce them at a trial or something.
There are all these things that are used to keep people in the system. If you violate probation or violate parole, it can be things that are very minor.
Child support.
I mean, that is one of the biggest scams foisted on the public. The system is made so that the non-custodial parent, usually a man, it's impossible, generally because they're poor, generally because they don't work.
Right.
You can go to jail, you can be fined, you can lose a job, you can have your car taken away, so you don't have means to earn a living. Some places, if you don't have a car, you're not getting a job. So that has been used to put people in the system, and that also becomes a profit center because child support enforcement, child support collection in many places has been privatized.
That's right.
So there are corporations that make money off of this. And then you have people in the prison system, and they're used to make money. So every effort to criminalize, and people are always whipped up into a hysteria about, in this case, deadbeat dads or drug kingpins. There's always some term that's invented to get people to be afraid or angry and willing to lock people up. But I think at this point, I think we need to say nothing new needs to be criminalized. Because we can see what a scam it is.
Yeah, the deadbeat dads was also a Clinton innovation.
Yes.
Let me ask a question. In terms of organizing something like this, what can people on the outside do to facilitate it?
Well, I think people have to educate themselves about the nature of the incarceration system. You know, in a way, it is the perfect crime, because people who are incarcerated are, if they're thought of at all, are thought of with disdain or with fear or with hatred. They shouldn't have done something wrong. They deserve to be there. They obviously, it is said, no matter what it is, they are at fault for having done something. But I think people need to realize how the system works. Most people in prisons never even went to trial. They are people who are poor. They can't afford good defense attorneys. They're taking a chance, black people with mostly all white juries. That is another tool of the system, keeping black people off of juries. So you have a choice of accepting a plea agreement, knowing you're going to go to jail, but for a shorter period of time, or taking a chance with the trial and getting the book thrown at you. So we have people for very minor offenses. Most people in this country in jail have not committed violent crime. You're not talking about people. Most of them are not dangerous people. They're not killers, not rapists, haven't committed an assault. I think it's important for people to know who is behind bars, why people are behind bars, and that most of them can be released without a danger to the larger society. But that requires some effort of education on our part, so that we don't have this, and respectability politics in the black community, where people think falsely that by aligning themselves with the narrative of the larger community and making themselves respectable, and it can be everything from no sagging pants to being tough on crime, that somehow our lot will improve. But we know that that is a ruse. And we all need to be against this system that creates so much, that ruins the lives, obviously, of those behind bars, that destroys families, that continues to punish people forever. With convictions, there's a plethora of jobs that people cannot get. You can't get a license to be a barber in New York State if you have a conviction.
Right.
There are ban-the-box efforts to keep employers from asking about criminal convictions early in the hiring process, and that's a good thing. But in reality, there are hundreds of jobs that people cannot get once they have a criminal record. So all of these things just keep feeding the system.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.